rational ignorance. What tends to grow into the spaces created by rational ignorance are binary politics, in or out, with us or against us, group versus group. And these sorts of binary politics invariably lead us to new and renewed forms of division rather than prudence. An obstacle to the democratization of prudence on the question of AI is the extent to which states are captured by the tech industry. And by state capture, I don't mean corruption here, but rather the sheer weight of corporate interest built into the state's decision making, where we are consumed with questions of which products are lucrative to market, which regulations are resisted. These are the kinds of questions that dominate the shape of our society's relationship with AI. Several writers, ranging from feminist structural theorists such as Iris Marignan, who's had perhaps the greatest influence on the way I think about politics, through to Mustafa Suleiman, the CEO of Microsoft, they all see social movements as perhaps, and perhaps mini-publics like citizens' assemblies, as the way to overcome the burden on the individuals in the public to act alone, to counter state capture, as I've described it, and to bring the interests and concerns of ordinary people to the front of how we grapple with these bigger structural questions, such as our society's relationship with AI. Certainly, much positive change to the way governments and industry respond to public calls of injustice comes through civil society. These sorts of approaches remain a vitally important mechanism of change, but they're not sufficient. Social movements tend to rely on methods of protest and semi-legal methods of occupation and obstruction, which can be very effective, but are often challenging to fund and sustain over long periods with directed effect. These methods also tend to be driven by a small number of committed activists who must galvanize larger numbers around big messages, but tend to struggle to bring those numbers into complex operative discussions on how to get governments to help their objectives.
You're listening to Jude Brown on AI's Promise and Peril. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Famously, when asked what action should be taken to combat climate degradation, Greta Thunberg, perhaps the most famous climate change activist in the world, replied, "It's nothing to do with me." This is, of course, not a statement about the lack of knowledge or imagination or care, but rather a reminder that our political institutions are where the details are bashed out into policy and where the large-scale coordinating power is held, like it or not. So I want to leave you with a brief sketch of a different idea that I think we ought to try. And I'm sort of compelled here by, again, Stuart Russell says that the success of his field is potentially to the detriment of humanity. And so I think what's imperative is the success of my field, of politics, in the general sense. And we have to put a lot more effort, a lot more thought, in the Arendtian sense, into the trends that are taking place, and not lose sight of the collective action problem that we face, which is really considerable. So I think there's something really extremely powerful about a well-organized citizens' assembly, and I've written quite a lot about them. I won't go into huge amounts of detail here, but you have a large, diverse group of ordinary people selected much like a jury duty from a wider population, and they're brought together and presented with competing evidence from experts in a range of societal interest groups and the views of the wider public. It's a choreographed event for which you are taken out of your everyday existence for a set period of time and immersed in the details of a particular topic and required to think critically on how to navigate a given societal problem or challenge. Your deliberations are open to the public, but your decisions are anonymous. Now, I've been particularly interested in the citizens' assemblies in Ireland which, and I'm thinking of the 2016 one in particular, which turned a totally divided nation on intractable social problems such as abortion, and led to an extraordinary national referendum which reflected almost exactly the decisions and the views that were eventually come to in the Citizens' Assembly. So there's something transformative. You can't really put your finger on it. These are conditions that you don't experience in an everyday, in the everyday. They have to be choreographed. You have to be lifted out and put into a particular context where you're exposed to different ideas, different competing sets of evidence, public views, interest groups, the whole gambit. And you think in the sort of Arendtian sense. But the problem with citizens' assemblies is that they're very expensive. So the one I just described in Ireland, was the cost of it was about 2 million euro, and it went on for well over a year. So that's long, cumbersome, expensive, and also citizens' assemblies tend to operate outside of our political machinery, kind of knocking on the window a little bit like social movements. So my suggestion is to bring them in. So when thinking about democracies, we tend to focus on the chambers of debate between elected members of government and opposition. But the reality includes a vast set of public body institutions whose function it is to work out the expert details and to make recommendations and think through the ethical issues, and then to feed that into the elected politicians' debates and decision-making. So in the UK, for example, but these exist in all sort of democracies, there are about 300 such bodies. There used to be 900. There's 300 such bodies. They employ about 300,000 staff, and they have budgets of about £250 billion. Now, in my work, I'm particularly interested in the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, which was actually first designed by a philosopher, Mary Warnock, who crystallised the idea that no matter how complex, and I think this is really important, no matter how complex the topic, laypersons should be involved, and no such authority should be unduly influenced by sectional interests. I've only touched on the general themes in a book that's coming out later in the year, where I spend quite a lot of time discussing the nature of politics and its relation to structural injustice. In the empirical example, I think about Warnock's ideas about what does this huge monster of a bureaucracy look like? What can it look like? And sadly, I mean, I didn't think she took her ideas far enough. I would definitely take them much farther. But even the ideas that she did have didn't really materialise in the way that she perhaps intended. And I write a sort of institutional history of where I think that kind of went wrong. But nevertheless, the HFEA has been a remarkably important body for the ethical and regulatory management of reproductive and genetic technologies. It is the gold standard in the world. It deals with really complicated thorny ethical issues like the creation of artificial wombs and embryonic materials and restrictions on human cloning, and these have been emulated the world over. I think about the limitations of democratic governance structures, but once imagined, once you get hold of this idea that actually there's something that's more than the sums of its parts with a lay element, the shape of it is pretty easy to sketch. And I think we should have some such body for AI. Now, the primary features would be much like a current model of a public body, funded through the state, operating arm's length to be independent of political steering. It's an ethical and policy-forming body which advises elected members of government on substantive questions and with subsequent regulatory powers. So not like all the advisory committees that exist around AI, which are packed with industry, but this would have a very heavy duty lay-centric element to it. Obviously, the whole point of it, like a citizens' assembly, is to engage with expertise emanating from specialists from different perspectives, and with the ability to explain and interpret the underlying technicalities of any particular question or concern. So in this way, The public, through these lay representatives, take on an active habit of political responsibility that you can't do in your everyday ordinary life. And this is the most important point. They provide a simple but potentially heavy counterweight to tech interest in policymaking. So to bring a range of lay voices directly into the mix of discussions around the relationship that society has with AI is an active, forward-looking approach. Should we permit technology in this realm? If so, how much? Should we tax companies for technological unemployment and environmental footprint? Should we ban lethal autonomous weapons? Should we insist on algorithmic audits for social media? Should we ban AI impersonation? I think the answers that we would get from a lay-centric body would be greatly different to the one dominated by industry, with only lip service to public polls and focus groups. A lay-centric approach would be a radical shift in our democratic operations, but one that I think is actually achievable. So many talks and podcasts, articles and books on the pros and cons of AI, like we've heard today, end with a plea for someone, whether it be you or the younger generation or the grown-ups, to take responsibility for protecting humanity from the spectre of tech-generated harm. What this someone is supposed to do is always opaque. There is never a blueprint offered of what should happen next, but there's always a description of how bad things will be if responsibility isn't taken up quickly enough. So rather than load up the future on our younger generations with the responsibility to correct our mistakes or defer to the elusive grown-ups, this is something we can do. To steer the future to a place where we know the questions to which technology is or is not the answer. So having created remarkable technologies and tirelessly deployed his genius ideas to the war effort, Turing ended his life at the age of 41, having been subjected by the state to chemical castration for being gay, and it is a tragic and deeply unjust end. But Alan Turing was a man who believed in the possibility of the extraordinary. He was living proof of that belief. And what is required now is something of the extraordinary in changing how our democratic states function. We might not want to mirror the decisions of Erewhon, but we ought to at least overcome thoughtlessness and consider seriously the sorts of prophecies that motivated the Erewhonians' extraordinary solutions to the malign possibilities of AI. And I like to think that's why Alan Turing ended his essay in the way that he did. Thank you. Thank you. I don't want to give the impression that I'm a Luddite. I think technology is extraordinary. I find it, you know, a kind of magic. And I'm not advocating that we do what the Erewhonians did. But I am interested in the possibility that they are, you know, they can do something politically radical. And I, as I said, I like to think that's why Turing put that at the end of his essay, rather in the way that people usually think it ends. Now, there is something about the recognition of what happened to communities that were dependent upon particular technologies. And I think Keynes, sadly, was very naive politically about the generations that will really suffer if we just forge ahead with technological unemployment and say, never mind, it's all in the greater good. So I think those stories of, you know, whether it be looms or whether it be coal mines, or, you know, we have to be very cognizant of what happened to those communities. None of it was positive. And we should do better politically. So I absolutely think that there's a very important message from that group, but I'm not advocating that we just, you know, have a binary of, you know, against or for. I think technology is wonderful and it's here and it's developing, but we have to do better politics. You know, so you might say the same about genetic technologies, and yet the HFEA has done this marvellous job, and people see how it's worked, how it's facilitated research, in fact. It hasn't shut it down, but it's done it in such a way that's given trust, people use it, and there's a kind of forward positivity around these really quite ethically complicated technologies. So there's a reason to get involved. Then people say, especially when it comes to sort of big, scary AI, well, China's going to do it, so this is what Stuart Russell says, so maybe we should just keep that race going. But actually, China have regulated even more fiercely than the US have. And actually, there's a worry that the state will be undermined if all of these technologies and algorithms are flying around without any sort of control over them. So again, the worries about technology are very real, but we have to do more to audit them. And there has to be a demand supply. At the moment, people put stuff out and people start using it, and then we see if it does harm. That's a really stupid way of allowing these technologies to develop. Whereas with drugs, for example, we do clinical trials, it's very rigorous. We should adopt that kind of mentality. We're not going to stop it all, but there's an awful lot that we can do. And I'm very clear that we shouldn't be throwing up our hands and saying there's nothing we can do. That defeatism is the opposite of political responsibility. So we just have to do it. Set good examples and try to bring people with us.
With GDPR, I saw a study recently that was talking about how it affected different companies of different sizes and their, how much money they earn and how their day-to-day operations are affected, and with smaller companies, they found that the earnings of those companies were negatively affected, or maybe the I don't really know the right financial words, but they had to hire people to take care of the data and everything, and the bigger companies were less affected. They already had the resources, and I guess one worry there is that how do we handle regulation in a way that we don't, sort of fuel monopolistic, tendencies that these technological setups already have.
Yes.
So do you have any?
Yes, thank you. Two answers to that. I think that states like the UK ought to be investing so that smaller sort of entrepreneurial companies or individuals are not limited in, because they don't have these kind of resources. So that should be a directed state intervention into, supplying grants to compliance grants, that kind of thing. So that's one way of answering that question. The other is that states have stepped out of this field increasingly. I mean, it used to be, all the funding and research was kind of directed through the military, and then it sort of splurged out into other areas. And I now just with these huge tech companies, the states are clients, and I think it, depending on the state, obviously, but they should step in more. They need to be at the centre of development so that we're not just buying products from the tech companies and then, putting them out there and hoping that, see what it does to our society. We should be, and that's where, on a micro level, what I'm talking about is involved, where we're stepping in and saying what we want, and then we fund that so that it's viable, either for small individuals and companies or the big tech companies too. There's definitely no silver bullet here. There's no sort of future where it's all easy. That's not politics for you. I think it matters. I mean, the ICC will hold individuals responsible. It's not a lot in the moment, but it's something to set the future. And it does perhaps, hopefully, make some think about their actions and other organisations similarly. You're right. I mean, we're all guilty of it. We're desperate to get something off the internet. Something pops up, we just say, yes, anything, just let me get to the site that I want to get to. And that's really terrible. And a friend and colleague of mine has working on this brilliant idea, which is called Data Trusts at Sylvie Delacroix. And this kind of middle, sort of middleman, if you like, which you can... It's sort of filtering your engagement with tech and data. It does require an opportunity cost, so it's like investing. You basically have to say, this data trust over here, I see that it will release my data to, this environmental agency or this, whatever, of who knows. And so you can sort of pick and choose what you're happy with. So there is that that investment cost. But people are thinking very creatively about how to get between you and just handing over all your data to these tech giants who are using it for their own profit and actually perhaps diminishing us a little by little. So I think we need to work with those really creative ideas. Yes?
I don't want to make it more complicated, but I think one of the issues with AI, it's treated as a separate problem from other things. And I think there are two obvious reasons why it's not. And the first is the most obvious, which is that AI is deliberately interfering with our political system and is clearly manipulating it so that when you have your citizens' assemblies, they are themselves going to be, you know, to some extent, controlled by the tech. And I mean, I think that's a problem. The other one, which nobody talks about but concerns me greatly, is the sheer energy costs of AI. Sadly, I put this all together for a lecture, and I've totally forgotten all the numbers. But the sheer heat production of AI is massive,
yes.
And it's going to compete with the major heat industries. So it's actually strongly related to the climate change model problem. And I think one needs to bring these things together,
yes.
And it'll perhaps actually create greater appeal.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Citizens' Assembly, I would actually bring them in to our governance systems. That is the kind of the thought there. And that would be a quite complicated but different way of doing policy decisions. And yes, as I said, I'm not going to now come up with a list of things that process ought to do, but you might say, well, we will tax companies for their environmental footprint heavily. You know, there's all sorts of creative ways that we can get to those issues. It's not ideal, but we need to do more to address those kinds of things that actually the public really care about, but don't, you know, surface so much in the kind of lists of, of the corporate interests and that they play the predominant role in these policy decisions. So what I'm asking is a choreographed shift. And I'm not really promoting any particular conception of the public good or whatever. I'm just saying that we need to shift that weight of interest and we need to do it quickly. And I suspect that we'll be looking at very different sorts of sensibilities and concerns.
I was thinking about what you said about the role of the Human Fertility Project, which had actually spread its influence throughout the world. You said all over the place people are recognising its importance.
Mm.
And how, when we have citizens' assemblies, say, happening here in Britain, to address questions, let's say, about weaponry or the labour issues you're talking about, you could get sufficiently universal, quasi-universal sort of moral points that would reach across boundaries, let's say, to countries which have got completely different sort of cultures and political stances, because that would be so important. I mean, particularly on things like, let's say, drones or whatever it is being widely used. You might nevertheless be able to reach across, but that would require the Citizens' Assembly to be a very special kind of way of thinking, I think.
What I've set out is something quite, you know, quite micro and detailed for certain contexts. So I'm thinking very much of a certain sort of democratic country like the UK and just changing the way that the bureaucracy of its governance machines. So, but I do think starting there, you know, is a kind of bottom-up approach. And, I mean, the European Union, I mean, for all of its limitations, that piece of legislation is extraordinary. I mean, I don't think anyone would have predicted, you know, a decade ago that they would come in with some pretty heavy duty legislation on, you know, Meta and Google and I just don't think they thought that was possible. But that is a collective. And as I said, China is regulating heavily because it has its own concerns and interests about AI and how it interacts with its society. So I think we have to be open and we can't just throw our hands up in the air, which I see so many commentators doing, saying it's all too much, you know, someone will break the agreement, somebody will do it first. We just can't think like that. We have no alternative but to move forward and do the best we can and set the best standards and actually make it appealing to have great technology that is not a threat to us all. That's all we can do. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You were just listening to Jude Brown on AI's Promise and Peril. She gave the Alan Turing Lecture at King's College in Cambridge, England, in early May 2024. Jude Brown is head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at King's College. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Naomi Klein, Ilan Pape, Tariq Ali, Medea Benjamin, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Jude Brown, AI's Promise and Peril, and for the classic book, The Essential Noam Chomsky, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Pink Floyd. Welcome to the Machine.